You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, April 9th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Why on tape? Because it is my daughter's vacation, and thus somebody's got to be on daddy duty. And that daddy dutier is me. But for you today, of course, we haven't left you empty-handed. Great interview with author and professor of management and professor of economics from the Johnson School of Management at Cornell University, Robert H. Frank, on his latest book, The Darwin Economy: Liberty, Competition, and the Common Good, published in September of 2011. Fascinating look at the notion of just how much of an economist it turns out Darwin was. Contrary to those libertarian ideas of Adam Smith's invisible hand in the market, we'll find that conservatives misread Adam Smith. That invisible hand, it seems, doesn't quite function as well as, well, even Adam Smith thought. Although Adam Smith, I think, we'll find, didn't even think that the invisible hand was magic. He just thought it was invisible. And it could only lift so much. Well, enough of my horrible metaphors, ladies and gentlemen, because we have today a great interview that I did pre-recorded last week with Robert H. Frank. I will be on vacation all this week, but you will get all new, brand spanking new material. Great interviews. We've got Thomas Frank coming up later in the week. We've got Chris Mooney. We've got Jessica Valenti. We've got the makers of Queen of the Sun. All this and more. So enjoy today's interview with Robert H. Frank. We'll be back tomorrow with another great show. Joining me now, it's a pleasure to welcome to the program Robert Frank. He is an economics professor at Cornell's Johnson Graduate School of Management and a regular Economic View columnist for the New York Times and a distinguished senior fellow at Demos. His latest book is The Darwin Economy: Liberty, Competition, and the Common Good. Welcome to the program, Robert.
Thanks for having me on with you, Sam.
So let's start just with the central and primary premise of your book is that contrary to our basic understanding of economics and sort of the academics of economics, Charles Darwin, it turns out, is a far more instructive economist than, say, Adam Smith.
That's one of the claims I try to defend in the book, yes. And it's not that Smith didn't have his finger on a really important phenomenon. The invisible hand idea, I think, will endure as one of the great intellectual achievements of mankind. It's just that I think some of his modern disciples have oversold the idea. It was never really Smith's view that you could turn selfish people loose and tell them to seek their own interests in the marketplace and expect that you'd get generally good results for society as a whole. What was amazing to Smith was that you often got good results when selfish people sought their own interests. Darwin was the one who saw more clearly that than Smith did, certainly, that individual and society's interests are often in conflict. Group interests point left, individual interests point right, and when there's a conflict like that, it's usually the individual interests that trump.
So really, I mean, a careful reading of Smith suggests that it was less a maxim that you always get good outcomes from this invisible hand when individuals pursue their own self-interest, and more that sometimes you do.
Right. Yeah, I think if you read Smith very carefully, he was quite circumspect about his claims. He was very worried primarily about actors in the marketplace who might have the power to exploit consumers or workers. That's a very common concern even today when you listen to social critics. Oh, we would like to give more power to the marketplace if only it were more competitive, but there are all these actors with a lot of power and we don't dare do that. I think that's not really the right diagnosis anymore. It may have been in Smith's day, but monopoly isn't really the problem now. I think the problem is much more like the kinds of problems that Darwin saw, where what you do and what I do turn out to be mutually offsetting. It was Darwin's central insight that life's graded on the curve in important ways. It's not how well you perform, it's how well you perform relative to the people you're competing directly against. And in situations like that, you often see arms races in effect. People try to outdo one another in ways that end up being profoundly wasteful.
All right, before we get to the notions of arms races and this notion of relative consumption, let's talk about how you give an example in your book of when behavior or I guess characteristics that might help the individual can almost necessarily hurt the collective. I mean, when I think about this, I think about, in modern day, a similar problem that's in the news is antibiotics.
Exactly.
For every individual, and I guess I'm more conscious of this because my wife has just gone through a bout of Lyme. But on one hand, she needs these antibiotics to take a lot of antibiotics to get rid of the Lyme. On the other hand,
right,
we know that the use and the increasing use of antibiotics creates strains of disease that we can't fight because it becomes resistant to antibiotics.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's just a great example of why what it pays the individual to do often doesn't add up to an overall outcome that we like. So,
tell us about
if you have a sore throat or an ear infection, the doctor will prescribe antibiotics for it. It would have gotten better on its own in a few days, but you're a little bit more comfortable if you get rid of it more quickly. But the problem with that is that if everybody's using antibiotics indiscriminately, there do emerge these drug-resistant strains. And so, yeah, your wife has had a lot of trouble because those drugs were overprescribed.
And tell us your elk example, because I think this also illustrates it quite well. And this relates directly to Darwin.
Exactly, yeah. Darwin was very interested in these kinds of runaway sexual features that seem to pop up in polygynous species, ones where the males take more than one mate if they can. And so one example of that is the massive antlers of the bull elk. The North American elk has antlers that now span something like 4 feet. They weigh 40 pounds. They're a huge appendage bolted to the animal's head. They got to be so big as part of a selection process where the bulls fought with one another for access to females. You know, like males in most vertebrate species, they try to take more than one mate if they can. And so if you see some males taking more than one mate, that means others don't get any. So naturally, they're going to fight bitterly for the opportunity to take mates. And antlers were the weapons. So if there was a mutation that coded for larger ones, that would be very heavily selected in the next generation. And then other mutations would accrete on top of the existing ones. And so we had this runaway process where we've got these surviving bulls with huge antlers. But the antlers, from the point of view of bulls as a group, turn out to be grossly dysfunctional. If you're chased into a wooded area by wolves, you're not very easily able to turn and maneuver, and so you're surrounded and killed quite easily. If all their antlers were smaller by half, the fights would be decided the same way as before, and they'd all be better able to escape from predators, but that's not the way it works. They're stuck with these big antlers.
Yeah, and particularly because elks don't really have the capacity to dictate limitations on their antlers, I guess.
Exactly. You know, if they were smart enough and could organize, they would enforce an agreement whereby at the count of three, all antlers get cut back by half. They'd have a very strong incentive to do that. But, of course, they can't do that.
And, of course, apparently there are essentially more male elks than you need to propagate the race. So the idea of the individual elks, a certain amount of individual elks being eaten by the wolves, is not a problem in terms of maintaining the species.
Yeah, I don't think elk as a species are threatened by the vulnerability of males. I mean, biologists have long remarked that there are way more males than a sexually reproducing species needs. You know, a small fraction of the existing males could sire all the offspring that the next generation could support. So, yeah, that's not a problem. The point is not that the species is in danger in this particular example. It's that the males, if they could make the agreement to cut their antlers back by half, would all be happier. They'd be less likely to be eaten by wolves if they did that. And no other outcome that they care about would change. So it's the males that are really the disadvantaged group in this example.
And that sort of collective decision relates to this concept of relative consumption. And I want to get there, but before we get to there, what is the problem that your book is looking to solve? In other words, what the lessons that we learn in distinguishing Smith and Darwin and their relative value to society is to address what problem that exists?
Well, what the book is really trying to do is to deepen our understanding of why we act collectively in so many situations. The standard free market religion says, let people do whatever they want to do and you'll get good outcomes. That's true in some cases. We do get good outcomes. We've gotten enormously wealthy from the interplay of incentives and free markets, so not to sell that process short by any means, but no country in the world is without a government. All governments regulate behavior in a whole variety of ways. If you believe the free marketeers, they'd have you come away thinking that all of those regulations were for the worse. They made people less happy and poorer. That seems implausible. If that were true, why hasn't somebody started a country yet that doesn't regulate and everybody moves there if life's so great there? No, we regulate for good reasons, but I don't think we've understood very clearly what the reasons are up until now. Oftentimes we say we regulate because people are stupid. They need to be protected against their own incompetence. Or we regulate because we need to protect people from exploitation by powerful firms who would exploit them if we didn't regulate them. Those, I don't think, are compelling reasons for regulation. The real reasons we regulate, I argue in the book, is that we would otherwise compete bitterly against one another for scarce spots in the social hierarchy and in the process do a lot of damage to one another.
Would that competition be only for a position in the social hierarchy, or is that also for limited resources, or is that baked into the social hierarchy cake?
Yeah, again, think of Darwin's central insight. Life's graded on the curve. You don't have to be bigger than your rival or stronger or smarter than him. You have to perform better than him, and that depends on how big and smart and strong he is. So if it's about relative performance, think of the incentives. A nice example is, when do you start your kid in school? So the kindergartner in most states starts at age 5. If he's going to turn 6 during that academic year, he's got to start school then. If that were your decision as a parent, many parents would think about it in the following way. They'd say, I'm going to hold my child back a year. If I do that, he'll be bigger, he'll be stronger, he'll be more socially mature. Since school performance is graded on the curve, he's going to perform better in every grade from then on. He's more likely to be accepted to a good university, more likely to get one of the jobs everybody wants. And so, yeah, we'll have to have him around the house for next year, but that's a trade that's well worth making if you look at the effect on the future life course that he'll enjoy. But if I can do that, what's to stop other parents from doing that? So now we've got kindergartners starting at age 6, and then somebody would push another year out, so age 7 is the kindergarten start date, and pretty soon you've got 8-9-year-old kindergartners. To what end? They're not all going to do better in relative terms, since they're only 10% of any graduating class that can be in the top 10%. So what we've done in that case is we've said, by statute, your child has to start, if he turns 6, by December in a given year, whatever the date might be in your jurisdiction. And yes, that robs the parent of the freedom to decide for herself when to start her kid in school, but that's a freedom we don't want. You know, we would really rather not be able to make that decision individually, because if we do, then there'll be this arms race that serves no one's purpose.
And if anybody doubts that example, I know that there are people who do that. I mean, I know that certainly, you know, that there is in fact a sort of a red shirting that's going on, I think, with a lot of particularly boys. But that's a different story for a different day. But but I want to just back up for one second in terms of the notion of good outcomes. You know, because your book is in many respects a way of trying to bring together the sort of the disparate political economic ideologies in terms of being able to come to some form of consensus,
right,
on what will work in terms of government policy that will serve sort of the needs and the sort of the ideological predispositions of those on the libertarian right and those on the liberal left. And
right,
one of the problems that I think sort of almost is an antecedent to that debate is that notion of what we consider to be good outcomes. And so when you talk of good outcomes for society, what is that?
You know, there's a lot we'll never agree on, but there's so many things it would be easy to agree on if we framed the problems more clearly that I really confine my attention in the book to the easy cases. The good news is that there are so many easy cases. There are simple changes we could make, I argue in the book, that would make everybody better off than before. So we don't really need to reach the hard case where you have a vision of the good life that points left and my vision points right, and we have to somehow adopt a policy that's going to make one or the other of us worse off. No, we may have to make those kinds of choices at some point on some issues, but there are many, many issues where simple changes in policy would benefit all of us. Think about the issue of heavy vehicles. You know, you've got a person who's torn between buying a 7,500-pound SUV or a 3,000-pound station wagon. The station wagon handles better and has almost the same hauling capacity for carrying boxes and stuff around. It can't pull a trailer up into the mountains if that's what you need to do, but this person doesn't need to do that. And so he's almost indifferent between the two vehicles, but he buys the heavier one because he has a slight preference for it. That's really a bad outcome for society if you think about all the relevant effects of that, because the heavy vehicle puts every other motorist and pedestrian at greater risk of injury and death. And the person who was deciding which vehicle to buy had no reason to take into account that cost he was imposing on other people. We need to raise revenue to finance the government. If we didn't have a government, there'd be no army. We'd get invaded by a country that had one, and then we'd pay tax to that government. So we got to tax something. And in the book, my plea is to tax only those activities that we engage in that cause harm to other people. Because they're not taxed now, we don't have any incentive to take into account the harm we cause to others when we engage in those activities. So why not tax vehicles by weight in this example we're talking about? If you need a heavy vehicle, if that's important to your vision of what leading a good life is for you, then you'll pay the tax in recognition of the fact that you're causing risk of injury to others, and then you'll buy the heavy vehicle. We're not going to prohibit you from buying it. That's not the approach. It's just to put prices on activities that result in harm to others. There are too many of those activities going on now. If they were curtailed, the benefits of curtailing them would be greater than the cost of the people who had to make adjustments in order to curtail them, and so the net result when the dust settled would be everybody'd have a bigger slice than before. If you tax vehicles by weight, then you can reduce the income tax, you can reduce the sales tax, some other tax. Tax harmful activities, that's the main message of the book.
So we're leaving, and you know, you and I operate in sort of different worlds, because the libertarians that I will end up engaging will take issue even with that assumption, because they want simply the concept of more freedom, and by taxing that choice to have that larger truck or larger vehicle, you're infringing upon their liberty by garnishing their property in some fashion. But we perfectly willing to leave those people aside for this part of the
argument. Don't leave them out, Sam. Just pose this question to them. Ask them, do they believe they have the right to cause extensive harm to other people, even in pursuit of an activity that's not of much value to them?
Yeah, I guess
would they really want to say they have the right to cause harm to others?
Well, you'd be surprised at some of the conversations I've had, but
many will say that. But I think it's good. It's good to put them in a position where they're forced to recognize that their position requires them to make that statement.
Right. Exactly.
I'm a libertarian. That means I'm asserting that I have the right to impose substantial harm on other people, even in pursuit of an activity that I don't much care about.
Exactly. And
I don't feel comfortable asserting a right like that. You don't feel comfortable asserting a right like that. I'm guessing there'll be at least a few libertarians who are going to say, wait a minute, do I really want to assert that I have the right to do that?
Right. I'm sure there's a couple. So let's move on. Let's move on, because you're basically espousing at this point. I think this is a sort of a John Stuart Mill notion of just how far government can reach. And
Right. In
many ways, we're having this conversation in the wake of the oral arguments of the Affordable Care Act. And in many ways, that was at least underlying some of the government arguments in some respect, that the choice that one makes to participate or not in the insurance market, necessarily, because of the way that we deliver health care in this country, harms others in society.
Exactly. No, it's a perfect case study for the argument. If you want to say, I have the right not to buy health insurance, then you are saying, in effect, I have the right to impose costs on everyone else.
And in fact, not just costs. I mean, because we do not have everyone in the insurance market, it will, in this instance, perhaps prevent the ability to ensure that even people with pre-existing conditions get insurance, and could very well end up killing them.
That's what I'm talking about when I say they're asserting the right to cause harm to other people. They might be killing many other people. They're going to make everyone else spend more for insurance. They're going to prevent some people with pre-existing conditions from getting coverage at all. So what is this right that they feel they're entitled to assert? The insurance market can't function unless everybody is in the pool. That's the tragic flaw in private insurance markets as a device for providing health coverage. It's a bad business model, basically. But if you're going to do it, the only way it can work is if everybody has to be in the pool. If you want to say, I have the right not to be in the pool, you are saying, in effect, I have the right to impose harm on other people. What gives you that right?
Indeed. And so let's go to this notion of relative consumption, because it is a fascinating an idea, and it makes me recall an interview, and I think he's going to put this in his book, in fact, with Chris Hayes, about his notion of fractal inequality, which I think is a similar dynamic. And he expresses it as having gone to Davos and watching the millionaires regret the fact that they don't get to go on the top floor where all the billionaires are.
That's right.
And so explain to us your concept of, or and maybe perhaps it's not your concept per se, but the concept of relative consumption, which you talk about in the book. You touched on it briefly in terms of the redshirting the kids.
Right.
But I think you use another example of houses as well.
Sure. Yeah, I think this is another nice illustration of Darwin's insight that life's graded on the curve. You're a parent. You've got young kids. What do you care about? Well, we know that item number one on most parents' lists of concerns is to get their kids into a decent school. What's a decent school? Well, it turns out that it's inescapably a context-dependent idea. A good school really is a school that's good by local standards, one that's better than other schools. And if you're in the public school system, which most people are, the way you get into a good school is to live in a neighborhood that's served by one. Where are those neighborhoods? They're the ones that have more expensive houses, it turns out. The sons and daughters of people who earn a lot of money go to schools that, on average, are better than the schools that everyone else goes to. That's not a mysterious thing. It's true in every country, even countries like France, where the school budget's the same in every school district. Here it's exacerbated by the fact that property taxes are one source of school budget revenue, and so the expensive neighborhoods naturally have better funded schools too. But even without that, you'd see the relationship. So if I'm a parent and I want my son or daughter to go to a school of just average quality, what must I do? The logic of musical chairs is clear here. I've got to outbid 50% of all other parents, or else I won't get a house in an even average quality school district. My kids will have to go to a school where the other kids score in the 20th percentile in reading and math, and where they have metal detectors out front. nobody wants that, so they're going to bid as hard as they can to get into at least a school district that matches where they stand in the earnings distribution. So if you're in the middle of the earnings distribution, that means you have to outbid 50% of all other parents. And what's problematic about that is that everybody at the top, because of this fractal inequality that you mentioned, is spending more on houses. That means the people just below them spend more on houses. Why? Because it's their social reference point is the people just above them. They travel in the same circles as the people above them, and so now they need a bigger house because the people at the top have built one. Maybe now it's the custom to have your daughter's wedding reception at home rather than in a hotel, so they build bigger. And then the people below them build bigger. They travel in the same circles, and you get a cascade all the way down the income ladder. Now the median new house built in the U.S. was about 50% bigger than it was in 2007 than it was in 1980. Not because the median earner has more money. The median wage has stagnated during that time. It's because others are spending more, and they're spending more because people at the top are spending more. So it really is harder if you're the guy in the middle to outbid 50% of all other parents to hold your spot in the school quality distribution. Life's gotten more expensive for the guy in the middle just because of the extra consumption that's been spawned at the top by rising income inequality. So that's another form of harm to others.
And it creates a tremendous amount of waste. Let me ask you this. What do you think has... And maybe you have a different sense of this than I do, but my sense is that this relative consumption arms race, if you will, has been sort of unleashed in the past 30 years. In other words, this problem has become exacerbated. You mentioned it just in terms of the growth of the house, the average house from the 70s to today.
Right.
I don't imagine that there was a similar growth from, say, the 40s to the 70s.
It's all about income inequality. Yeah, the three decades right after World War II, income growth was at the same level, and actually a fairly high level, up and down the income ladder. You had 3% growth at the top, 3% in the middle, 3% at the bottom. Everybody was growing at about the same rate in terms of their purchasing power, and so you didn't see this kind of tilt in the spending patterns. Since about 1970, virtually all the income growth has gone to the top. That's the big change that's taken place. And we know that inequality is involved in this because Wiege Dyke and Adam Seth Levine, two collaborators of mine and I, did a study using census data, and we looked at the largest counties in the U.S., and the ones where income inequality grew the most were the ones where we saw the biggest growth in symptoms of financial distress. That's exactly what the theory of expenditure cascades would predict. It's those areas where the people in the middle have the hardest time keeping up with the standards set by people at the top. And that's where we've seen the biggest increases in bankruptcy filings, the biggest increases in divorce rates. That's the unmistakable symptom of financial distress. And the biggest increase in long commute times. People have to drive more than an hour back and forth to work. That's another thing families do when they can't pay their bills. They move further from the center where land's cheaper. So, yeah, inequality has been a main driver of these shifts in spending patterns that have made life tougher for people in the middle.
And so what has driven that income inequality?
Yeah, it's I think really ultimately technology and the information revolution. You didn't know who the best producers were around the world at one point. You couldn't even get a phone line to Europe when I was growing up. You had to, it was a special thing. Now everybody knows who's the best at every task, and so the high value users can find the best producers and they can pair up, and so there's been an enormous bidding. The people who are really good at what they do, the technology enables them to essentially serve a much broader swath of the world marketplace than ever before, and so the competition for the services of the most able producers in every sector has driven their wage up relative to everyone else's. And we're going to see that continue to happen. You know,
is it really just technology? I mean, we've seen through, for instance, this banking crisis. You have banks that have lost tremendous amounts of money, yet their CEOs get massive bonuses. I mean, is it really just technology that has driven this? Because wouldn't we have seen this? Let me ask you this. If it's just technology, presumably this same technology exists in other parts of the world. In fact, one could argue that the technology, broadly speaking, is more advantageous in other parts of the world.
It's not just technology. No, you make a good point, Sam, with the financial services industry, and generally across many industries. One thing that's also been happening is that people have been able to buy legislative favors with campaign contributions in a way that we never saw in the earlier decades. We were talking about, you know, the influence of money in political campaigns has just skyrocketed at the same time. That's been mainly a problem in the financial services industry. That's one of the least efficient, most damaging industries we have, but it's also been a problem in some other industries. But in most industries, it's not been about legislative favors. It's been that people have had a good idea and have been able to extend that idea out into a very wide domain. You know, the best soprano can serve the whole market now because we listen on compact discs, not in live concert halls. That's the story.
I just don't understand why the United States would have such growing income disparity over the past 30 years and not the rest of the Western industrialized world, presuming
it's happening in every country. It's happening more here than in other countries. Our market is more competitive than the markets in other countries. So it's the combination of technology and more open competition that really highlights this set of forces.
And perhaps,
but we're seeing in the UK and Australia, other countries that have relatively competitive markets, we see much greater increases in inequality there. The markets that are least competitive, the ones where there's most shelter from custom and legislative tradition, have seen the smallest growth in income inequality. But even there, I mean, we see tremendous growth in inequality all around the world.
And that income inequality that I guess we were sort of susceptible to because of those lack of protections was leveraged into a mutation of our laws that sort of enhanced that and increased, sort of provided steroids for it, I guess.
We're a perverse case. You know, most other countries have responded to the tendency for income inequality to grow by trying to lean against that wind with tax and social expenditure policy. We've done just the opposite. We've been cutting the social safety net, and we've been giving big tax reductions to people at the top of the income ladder. It's a very bizarre response to the set of economic forces that we confront now. And I think here, too, you see the influence of the money in political campaigns. You know, what possible reasoned argument could have led to a cut in tax rates for people at the top of the income ladder at the very time when those people have been enjoying all the gains from economic growth in the first place?
All right, so let's go to your proposed solution. It is a what you call a progressive consumption tax. Explain to us what that is.
Yeah, the general philosophy of policy intervention in the book that I try to defend is one where you don't tell people what to do. The diagnosis of the problem is that the incentives they face lead them to do too much of some things and not enough of others. And the best way to lean against that tendency is to just change the incentives that people face rather than try to micromanage their behavior. So the main proposal in the book is of that ilk. It's a proposal to scrap the income tax altogether, in its place adopt a very much more steeply progressive consumption tax. So what the family would do would be report its income just the way it does now to the IRS, ideally in a much simplified fashion. We don't need all the myriad exemptions, deductions, and other loopholes to contend with. We could strip a lot of that out. So report your income, then report how much you saved during the year. We know how to do that already from 401k and IRA and other tax-sheltered retirement plans. So you've got your income and your savings, the difference between those two numbers, your income minus your savings, that's how much you spent during the year. So that amount minus a big standard deduction, let's say $30,000 for a family of four, would be your taxable consumption. The rates start low. If you're a lower middle income family, your total tax bill is the same or lower than before. But the more you spend, the higher your taxable consumption is, the higher rate of tax you pay on the next dollar you spend. And here's the fiscal magic in a tax proposal like this. If you let the tax rates go up to a fairly high level at the top of the spending ladder, let's look at a family that's spending $2 million a year already. The tax rate on the next dollar of consumption for that family could be 100%. That would just mean that if it wanted to spend an extra dollar, it could, but it would have to pay an extra dollar of tax as well. So it in effect would just make extra consumption more expensive for you if you were spending already at a very high level. So think about how that would change your incentives if you were a rich family and thinking about adding a new wing onto your mansion that costs $4 million. That project is now going to cost you $8 million. And what we know is that even the rich respond to price incentives. That's why rich families in New York live in smaller living spaces than they do in cities where real estate prices are lower. So the family that was confronting that tax would say, well, wait a minute, a $4 million addition, we don't really need one that big. Let's build one that's only $2 million. That way we pay the contractor $2 million. We'll have to pay $2 million in tax. It won't cost any more than the original project would have. And here's the magic part of the process. Other rich families would reason in a similar way. So the additions would all be smaller, built onto the mansions. And once the dust settled, they would all realize that the new smaller additions were just as good as the larger ones would have been, because beyond some point, it's purely relative mansion size that matters. I think there would be good reason to believe that people would be happier if all the additions were smaller. It's just that you don't want a smaller addition when everybody else is building a bigger one.
Now,
and that's real money you save. That money could be used to fix roads and bridges that are crumbling all around us, or repair schools whose roofs leak, or do any number of things that we need to do that we say we can't afford to do.
Have you do you have a sense of where the rates would have to be? I mean, let's assume for the moment that we wanted it to be revenue neutral as of today. And frankly, obviously, I don't think we do. Our revenue is significantly lower as a function of GDP than when it's been in the past.
Right. But we need more revenue.
I'm just curious if you benchmarked those numbers. I mean,
it's a fairly simple calculation to do. The rates would need to be higher for a revenue-neutral consumer tax because you're exempting savings.
Right.
So you would need higher marginal rates. They wouldn't have to be 100% at the top. My argument for the very high top marginal tax rates is that they would be in the interests of the very, very rich families as well to have them be that high. You know, you think about the incentives that a tax system provides. If you were a smart rich guy, you would want to move to a place that had a very steeply progressive consumption tax, because you'd say to yourself, look, if I move there, I won't have to blow all the money I've worked so hard to create by building my business on pointlessly expensive coming-of-age parties for my kids, huge mansions because people like me are expected to be able to entertain in a certain style. If I moved to a place that had a steeply progressive consumption tax, all that grandiosity would be scaled back. Rational people wouldn't spend as much on that. They'd save and invest more. And so you'd build a bigger nest egg. You can't have too big a nest egg. Something could go wrong. You might need it. That's a good thing if you're a rich guy to have a high rate.
But Robert, let me ask you that. I mean, is a guy like, let's say, Bill Gates, for example, is that really an issue for them? I mean, is there really a progressive consumption rate that would be high enough that would actually change their behavior? I mean, I don't know what a billionaire, a multi-billionaire, could purchase you know, even at that 100% marginal tax rate, that would necessarily, you know, short of perhaps a country.
It's a great question, and you're absolutely right that there are many people whose income and wealth levels are so high that no tax we could even imagine implementing would make them unable to buy anything that's on offer. So absolutely valid point. But notice this, there are many such people right now in New York, and what's different about New York from Cleveland or Seattle or other cities? The real estate prices per square foot in New York are much, much higher. And if you look at the square footage of the dwellings that the billionaires live in New York, they're not small. They've gotten much, much bigger because of the huge increase in income at the top in New York. But they're much, much smaller than they are in those other cities. That's because a space doesn't need to be as big in New York to feel big, because everyone else is built smaller in New York because of the high real estate prices there.
Is that it, or is it just the co-op board just says, we're only going to let you do five floors? I mean,
you know, if people wanted to get around that, they could build their own buildings and build housing as big as, you know, how big is enough? The answer to that question always depends on, well, what do other people have around here? I want a place that seems big. To get a place that seems big, it has to be big relative to the places around. And you can see right away why that set of incentives, it's a perfectly natural human desire to want a place that seems big, but when everybody responds to that impulse, you get places that get bigger and bigger and bigger to no good purpose, because there are only a small handful at the end of that game that are going to seem big, because big is a relative concept.
I agree with that general notion. I'm not convinced, though, that if you don't have you have someone who is complete who you cannot in any way shape their incentives by extra cost. They continue to build that the same size apartment that they would otherwise, and you still have those poor, you know, 100 millionaires who are going, God, I feel like I'm depriving myself.
You know, yeah, but if those 100 millionaires respond to the incentives, as many will, their fortunes are going to grow more rapidly, and so maybe they'll be the ones at the top of the ladder after a few years pass. You know, they can put those dollars in tax-sheltered savings account and see their wealth grow while others are building big. If you want to build big, build big. You're going to pay a very steep contribution to the general revenue pool. So it's like the guy who pays a tax on his heavy vehicle. Yes, he's putting others at risk, but he's compensated for that by contributing to the fund that makes those people whole.
How would this impact the estate tax? I mean,
you'd definitely want to keep a robust estate tax with this, because let's face it, the rich would be better able to take advantage of the savings exemption in the in this tax. They would die with more money in the bank than they do now. If they've thought about it, they'd realize that it's not such a great idea to leave too much money to their kids. The thoughtful billionaires have already worked that out. You can leave an enormous amount of money to your kids under the existing estate tax. So I think the proposals to get rid of the estate tax are just ill-informed, basically. It's the best tax we have. You pay it after you're dead. You don't pay it unless you've really struck it rich. I think of it as a contingency fee contract with a lawyer. You don't pay your lawyer if you don't win your case under those contracts. I want good schools and good roads. Sure, I'll promise to pay an estate tax if I happen to die rich. I don't know if I will. Probably I won't. But if I do, then I'll happily see my estate taxed. I can get better schools and roads if I agree to that. And so why wouldn't we all want to agree to that? It's a great tax.
This progressive consumption tax is a fascinating idea. Do you have any sense that there's any support for this in any amongst any of the political class?
You know, everybody tells me, "Oh, that's a great idea, but it'll never happen." And you know, it is, I think, very difficult to talk about any tax in the current environment. We have a debate that's driven by mindless anti-tax slogans at the moment. And so if the moment you propose taxing anything, you get shouted down. The day will come, though, when we'll have to reckon with the deficits and what to do about them. We're not going to eliminate them by cutting wasteful government spending. You know, we've got millions of baby boomers set to retire. We're going to need more revenue. So where do we get it? We're going to have to actually think about that seriously. And once we do, this tax is going to bubble up to the top of the list of proposals. I published an article about it in 1997. And to my surprise, I got a very warm letter about a week after the article appeared in print from Milton Friedman, the patron saint of small government conservatism. He said to me in his letter, he didn't think the government should be raising more revenue right now. This was in the late 90s when budgets were headed into surplus. But if it did need more revenue, which now there's no doubt that we do, the progressive consumption tax would be far and away the best way to raise it. And the interesting kicker was he enclosed in the envelope a copy of an article he had published in the 1943 volume of the American Economic Review, in which he had proposed a progressive consumption tax as the best way to pay for World War II. So yeah, I think the conservatives can get behind this tax. They've always been in favor of consumption taxes. They want a flat tax or a sales tax. They'll never get that because that's so regressive. But I
don't want to just gloss over that. The difference between that, for people who don't understand that, a flat tax would be regressive in that it would, because it's not graduated in terms of consumption. If it's not graduated in terms of being progressive, higher as you go further, it would actually place a greater burden on those in the lower end of the income spectrum
than now. The numbers on all this came to light when the earlier in the Republican presidential primaries there were candidates proposing flat tax proposals,
999.
Which, as I say, are 999, essentially sales tax proposals. And those proposals all have the common feature that there are huge tax cuts for people at the top of the ladder and there are substantial tax increases for everyone else. We're not going to do that. I don't think any of those proposals will be adopted. But the progressive consumption tax could very easily be adopted once we're willing to acknowledge that we need more revenue from some source.
It's not something you would recommend now during a period of recession.
No, don't do it now. Actually, there's a step we could take that would kill several birds with one stone. Pass it into law now, but schedule it for gradual phase-in only after the economy is back under 6% unemployment.
Right.
If you did that, you'd sort of reassure the people who are worried about deficits. That's a long-run problem. We've got a new tax scheduled to come into effect in time to deal with it. But in the meantime, wealthy families would see, wow, if we're going to build a wing onto the mansion, now's the time to do it before this tax comes into effect. Let's beat the tax by building right away, and we'd get hundreds of billions of dollars worth of economic stimulus without a nickel of it being on the government budget. So that's not the best way to stimulate the economy, but better than nothing.
Indeed. Well, Robert Frank, the book is The Darwin Economy, Liberty, Competition, and the Common Good. Fascinating read, and I want to dig into it a little bit more, but it seems like an excellent solution to both the income disparity and, frankly, the rapid growth that we are going through, the unsustainability of many of our economic growth, and from an environmental standpoint, and also a great way to raise revenue.
It's something we need to talk about. Yeah, and I'm grateful for you giving me this much time to put the idea in front of your listeners.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Robert.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Satan, I prepare.